Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Heather Browning. Heather is a scientist, a philosopher, and a former zookeeper and animal welfare officer. She's now a researcher at the London School of Economics, specializing in animal sentience, welfare, and ethics. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the podcast as a whole, so why not write us a review? Every share, review, and rating helps us nudge a few more people towards compassionate, rational thinking. A big thanks to Christina H83 and Janina Terzi for your recent 5-star reviews. That's very kind. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info, or just search for sentientism on any social media platform. You'll be made welcome in our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Hi, Heather, how are you?
Hey, I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join this series of Sentientist Conversations. And as you've given, you're an early joiner to our Sentientism Facebook group, and you were one of the earliest people to add yourself to our wall of sentientists too. So as you well know, I guess what I'm trying to do with this series of conversations is to focus on the two deepest, most important philosophical questions. What's real? How should we best understand the universe? And what matters morally? And I've got an obvious bias, of course, and I'm trying to frame and raise awareness of and build community around this idea of sentientism, which I've stolen from 1970s animal advocacy academia and trying to turn into something that's more broadly understood. And it answers those two questions. One, in saying when it comes to what's real, we should take a naturalistic approach that with humility and open-mindedness uses evidence and reason to, you know, always imperfectly try and understand and build beliefs about the world. So it's a naturalistic approach. And when it comes to what matters, the clue is in the name. We should have moral consideration or have compassion for any entity, any being that is sentient, that has the capacity to experience good things, bad things, suffering, flourish. But in these conversations, I'm talking to people who agree and disagree. Again, it'll be interesting to see where the conversation goes. But before we get into that, how would you best introduce yourself for people who don't already know of your work?
Yeah, so I guess I've got this sort of interesting interdisciplinary kind of background and work focus now.
Yeah.
So I started out when I was first a student studying biology at university, so I had a science background. And at that point, I was quite convinced I was going to go into probably field zoology. So I was getting myself set up for getting out and studying animals in the wild. And I guess there's always been this focus, and you'll see this throughout, that the focus of my work is very much on animals.
Yeah.
But yeah, the exact way in which they were being incorporated has changed a lot. So yeah, I started out doing these zoological studies, which I liked quite a lot, but probably didn't love the data collection and data analysis part of it. So even though I really enjoyed engaging with the science, actually, so, you know, doing the science wasn't what I was really in love with. And around that same time, I started volunteering at my local zoo. So I'd go there a couple of afternoons a week when I had time off from school, and really loved that. So I just answered an ad in the newspaper. This was 20 years ago, so that's where you'd actually still see ads in the newspaper.
And how people used to get jobs, yeah.
Yeah. So my mum actually cut this little clipping out of the newspaper for me and turned up at the zoo. And yeah, from the first day, just absolutely adored the work there. So I got there one morning very early, and pretty much the first thing I had to do was sit down and cut a whole lot of fish up to feed to the penguins. And at this point, I'd never touched a fish in my life, and the whole thing was pretty bizarre. But within the context of what I was doing there at the zoo, it all just felt okay, and all my usual squeamishness, or this work was quite physical, it was quite difficult in a lot of ways, and none of that seemed to matter. I just really loved it. So when I finished my degree, instead of going into following a PhD at that time in zoology, I left to go and pursue this career in zoo work, and I did that for a very long time. So I ended up working at that and then several others. So I've worked a few zoos around Australia and in New Zealand as well. And yeah, just getting into that, just spending time with animals on the ground day to day, husbandry, looking after them. And yeah, just really enjoying getting to know these different animals. It's this job that's this constant sort of challenges of dealing with the new things the animals throw at you, because every day they've got some new kind of quirk or issue or different personality traits. And also dealing with just all the management challenges of working with enclosures and working outdoors. And so I did that for a very long time and really liked it. But after a while, started getting itchy feet again to get back into studying. So I've been this kind of lifelong student. And ended up moving back home and going back to university, and this time to study a degree in philosophy. So essentially I was just looking for something very different than what I'd done before, and I liked this idea of studying in the humanities. And at the time I didn't even really know what philosophy was. It just had this vague kind of appeal to me. And so I thought I'll start this Bachelor of Arts and major in philosophy and see what happens. And sat down in these first philosophy classes and just realized that, okay, this is what I've been doing my whole life. This is what I've been really interested in, asking questions and examining the world through this analytic kind of frameworks. And it made a lot of sense to me. And particularly in my second year, I did a class in philosophy of biology. And that was when everything clicked together. It was like, oh, wow, here's this way that I really like approaching the world, this philosophical method, and this biology, which was when I did my undergraduate in science, what I really loved was all this biological science. But as a philosopher of science, as a philosopher of biology, I can engage with that science from a much more theoretical and conceptual point of view, and I don't have to sit down and do the actual maths and the statistics and all the things that weren't my favorite parts of the science to start with. So it felt like the best of both worlds, that I was able to bring together this my love of philosophy and also this scientific background and engaging with the biological sciences. And yeah, that to me just seemed like absolutely what I wanted to do. And so I applied through for a PhD. And as I was doing that, realized that I could start addressing some questions in animal welfare. And that was where this sort of third strand came back in of my life as a zookeeper, that all of a sudden I was like, okay, everything that I've been doing so far can all tie together and build this research program where I can bring together everything that in the past I've been really interested in and use all that to build these ideas. And so that was really exciting for me. My first project that I started on came from the work I'd done in the zoo. So the background story to this is, when you're at a zoo, one thing you do is a lot of keeper talks and interactions where you talk to members of the public and, you know, trying to help them, educate them about your animals and their conservation. And when I was doing talks around the cheetahs, people would often ask, oh, do you give them the opportunity to run? Can they run around a lot? And our sort of standard response to that is, well, they don't really like to run. You might see in a documentary that a cheetah is running around chasing its prey all the time. They're really fast. But in the wild, a cheetah spends 30 to 60 seconds of its day running flat out and the rest of its day basically resting, because they run so fast that they put themselves into muscle meltdown and they cannot even move for 20 minutes. Even if they catch a prey, they can't even start eating it for 20 minutes after they've caught it, because they're so worn out from this. So it's not necessarily actually a pleasant experience for them to run if they don't have to. It's not necessarily something they choose to do. And so I guess, you know, in saying that, it started me thinking, how do we know whether or not this is true? Why should I think that animals want or don't want to do certain things, or what's good or bad for them? And how could we find out? And so that's what got me into thinking about animal welfare science. And I wrote my honours thesis at the time about the role of natural behaviours in the determining the welfare of animals. And that kind of came out of this, was trying to understand what it is about natural behaviours for an animal that actually determine its welfare. And from that, I did my PhD thesis in general on how we measure animal welfare. So it was very much engaging with the science of animal welfare, how it is that we sit down and essentially figure out from an animal's point of view what makes its life better or worse without using our kind of preconceived notions about what that is.
Yeah.
And that's the research program that I'm building on now. So I've now taken on a postdoctoral research fellowship at the London School of Economics in a project that's called the Foundations of Animal Sentience. And that's my primary investigator there is Jonathan Birch. And he's essentially set up this program, which is trying to investigate the questions about the science of animal sentience, how that links to animal welfare, which is my particular part of the project, and some of the ethical and policy implications of what we understand about animal sentience and welfare. And so it's been this really perfect opportunity. It's like my dream postdoc that came up as I was finishing my PhD to just do exactly what it is that I was interested in and be able to pursue that research.
Yeah, it's a fascinating journey. Lovely. Thank you. And I think one of the things we'll come back to is the centrality of, yeah, we can never do this perfectly, but trying to genuinely take the perspective of the sentient animal, or trying to get as close to it as we can, is, I think, foundationally important to any sort of moral stance, but difficult, and maybe in a perfect sense, impossible. Maybe we'll never get there, but it has to be a genuine effort. And you can see some obvious implications where we don't even try to take that perspective and therefore cause enormous needless harm. But you can also see quite well-meaning approaches where we take a fairly naive human approach and project, you know, anthropomorphize in an inappropriate way to animals.
that can also, you know, end up causing or obviating harm in some way as well. Yeah, that's an interesting perspective I think we'll come back to.
Yeah, because I think that's something I find interesting as well.
So. Yeah, and the other thing that is fascinating about your background is that interdisciplinary approach as well. So I'm an amateur in every single one of these fields, but that makes it easy for me to flip from one to the other. And when I find myself getting frustrated with a perspective, it's quite often because it seems narrowly fixed within one of those disciplines. So it might be someone who's very into philosophy, but hasn't really looked into the science of the underpinnings of information processing or sentience or biology, or, and it can work in many different ways, but it feels to me in general that any one of those disciplines would be enriched by at least a slightly better understanding of how all of those different things plug together. So the fact you've done, you know, biology, philosophy, zoology, enormous amount of in practice experience, you know, living with non-humans at the same time is a wealth of experience to bring to bear.
Yeah. And it's something that, you know, I hope to be able to do is bring all these things together, and also to be able to communicate with all of those different sort of spheres as well, is that bring sort of philosophical concerns to people in science and bring the philosophy and the science to people who are in the industry or working with animals, and so they can understand what we're thinking about, bring the science into philosophy, all those sorts of things, and have all these people start to open their minds up in different ways that they may not have considered before. Yeah. These other disciplines can provide that perspective.
Yeah, it's powerful. And that sets the scene quite nicely for, I guess, the two central questions we like to ask here, because in a way, the first one, what's real, is one about understanding reality. And the second one is switching gears into morality and what should matter morally. But in terms of that first one, what's real, for many of my guests, that's really a story about whether they grew up in a naturalistic or an atheistic or an agnostic sort of household and society, or one that was more spiritual and religious, some nature, and how they're thinking about the nature of the universe and the nature of reality has shifted over time, if it has. So I don't know how far you want to wind the clock back, but it would be fascinating to know your personal story and where you've got to now on that side of philosophy.
Yeah, so I think certainly the household I grew up in was probably a more sort of naturalist one than anything else. So I remember when I was very small going to Sunday school, and I think my family went to church a little bit, but yeah, that was the various early stretches of my memory. And I'm from quite a large family. I've got four sisters, so I suspect that was probably a large part of the reason that going to church was just impractical.
Yeah, just the logistics.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that's why. I think my parents were always fairly casual about it anyway. And certainly at this stage, they would consider themselves to be agnostic, if not atheist. Mm. I think that was something that they just did on a sort of a not very reflective basis in the past. And we certainly grew up in a household where I think we were just encouraged to find our own paths through that. So some of my sisters went to church, some didn't. I went through a period in high school, I think this is probably fairly common, that I joined a church group and went for a year or so, largely for the community of it. So there's something I think that when you're a teenager and having these groups of friends, one of the things you're trying to do is fit in the world. And there's something nice about the way that you're so welcomed into something like a church group. And you know, you go, they have these youth groups, they're singing, it's all very awe-inspiring in a way. One of the things that I still find is that this kind of religious music has these really strong emotional effects on you. And in some ways, I think that's not accidental. I think it's, there's particular ways that music can move your emotions, and it's very easy to mistake for a spiritual awakening of some kind. It's this deep emotional connection, but didn't actually amount to anything. And I guess that sort of petered out for me as I was just starting to question what was happening behind it all, going to these churches and being told that there were these rules for how I had to live and wanting to find out why, what was the problem, you know, with doing this. And you know, they might give some specific context and you're like, okay, but what if the context is such that the outcomes would be the same? Why would that then be a problem? For instance, like having sex before you're married, it's what if you're in serious relationship with someone, it would seem to, you know, be the exact same sort of thing, and this piece of paper mattered. And I don't know, all these sorts of questions came up that no one really had any particular answers to. It was just, you know, you have this one guidebook in a sense, and everything was supposed to come out of that. And that was very unsatisfying to me. And so
your philosophical mind was already
wanting to understand. And I guess that's got this sort of sciencey philosophical kind of background. And I think that's just the sort of family that we always had. It's just the sort of upbringing. I read a lot of books. That was what sort of child I was. I liked reading and I liked writing things. But we discuss things and ask questions and look at the world and see why things were the way they were. And so from that point of view, it was always okay to question things and to find out, to try and understand the reasons behind things and to try and figure out why things were the way they were and whether or not they could be different, whether there were better ways of doing things. And so I guess a religious worldview doesn't allow for much of that. And that was something that, yeah, I found fairly restrictive. And so, yeah, something that I didn't really carry on with. And yeah, like I said, obviously moved into science. And that just to me seemed like the best way of investigating the world, going, well, look, there are these things, there are all other natural phenomena. And, you know, the more I reflected on it, the less it made sense to me that there was anything beyond those sorts of things that, you know, when you think beyond this kind of naturalist worldview. And so going that, yeah, the tools of science, there may be many ways in which they're imperfect guides, because certainly we're flawed humans and we're only, I think, at the beginning of our scientific journey of trying to understand the world. I think we're not only close to a completed science. And so, of course, there are many things we don't understand and many things that don't seem to make sense yet. But, you know, I don't think that's because they don't make sense. I think it's just because either we don't have the tools to understand them yet, or possibly never will.
Yeah.
There are some things like consciousness in philosophy. There's this big thing where it's the hard problem of consciousness, that this idea that there seems to be this gap between understanding the mechanics of the way the brain works and understanding the experience, why there is this conscious experience that accompanies it. And to me, I always just wonder whether or not that's just because of the features of our brains, of our human brains, in that we're not necessarily going to understand the way everything complex in the universe works, because we're evolved creatures that have evolved to have sets of heuristics to understand parts of the world that we interact with that have been successful for us in the past. And there may be some things, we might be finding the same sorts of things as we hit quantum mechanics and stuff like that, some things that are just really complex to understand, or some things that get easier to understand if we just stumble into the right sorts of frameworks to get them. There are things that hundreds of years ago seemed very complicated to understand. And once the right sort of frameworks and the right equations and the right ways of thinking about them came to people, these things suddenly snapped into focus and became a much more simple.
And so, yeah. And I think there's a really strong drive in our evolved psychology that I think can lead you down that more religious path. So there's one is this a sense of wonder and reverence about the universe and everything that's going on. There's also, of course, a finely attuned agency detection, right? Where we're looking for an agent that does stuff, because in an evolutionary context, that's an important thing to understand, right? If there's something out there that threatens you or might benefit you. So we tend to impute agency sometimes where maybe it isn't. There's, of course, that sort of rich need for community and communal experience and ritual that comes out of our, again, a sort of evolved need for cooperation and kin and reciprocity and so on. So a lot of those boxes get ticked in a, you know, religious community or worldview. But I think there's also this drive for, you know, wanting perfection and clarity. And, you know, I think we just have to face facts that might not be available to us. We're just going to have to deal with it. But that need for perfection can either lead you to a somewhat arbitrary view, right? There is a God. They define what good and bad is. There are these rules. We don't, that's the end. We have perfection. We don't look too closely. So that can lead you down that road. But I think it can also be a challenge in a scientific worldview as well. That's one of the themes that's come through a lot of these conversations. And I need to remind myself of this as well, is that even a sort of scientific naturalistic worldview can sometimes come across as quite arrogant and we have all the facts and here are all the answers and do not challenge the established science. And I think you've already hinted at it there, where I think we need to recognize that those are human practices and processes. Yes, we should use evidence and reason, but we should be skeptical of our evidence. We should be skeptical of our reasoning. We should be skeptical of our tools. Doesn't mean they're useless, but we should, you know, always have that humility and doubt at the center. And fundamentally, just get used to the fact there's stuff we don't know. And as you said, there might even be stuff that is just unknowable, right? It's just, you know, evolved apes. We might have limits. That's not an excuse to stop pushing them, but.
That's right. Yeah, we still want to get the best possible understanding we can, but coming across something that we don't feel that we can fully understand, particularly when that kind of understanding is just that we don't intuitively grasp how it works.
Yeah.
I don't know that I feel that we should intuitively grasp everything. It would be nice, but it certainly doesn't seem to me obvious a priori that that's something that we are going to be able to do, and that that should count against particular sets of theories if they otherwise are the best kind of fit with our evidence. Like you said, what counts as our evidence is certainly pretty amorphous, that some people almost reify science, that it becomes a religion in itself, where they're just like, this has been published in a peer-reviewed publication, so it becomes like established fact. It's like a Bible in itself. And you're like, scientists are just flawed humans who make mistakes in their data and don't account for confounds in there.
Yeah, and have motivated reasoning and
sometimes
twisted incentives and
There's certainly a lot of ways in explicit and implicitly and deliberately and non-deliberately that scientists can get things wrong or get things that are twisted in certain sorts of ways. And that doesn't mean to say that they're not doing a good job, but it just means that we do need to take a critical eye to everything.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that we should be challenging everything. I guess you get people who push this too far the other way. They hear us say that, oh, science isn't perfect, and they assume that means that you can just as well deny that climate change is real as accept that it's real. And you're like, no, it doesn't mean that anything goes, but it certainly means, particularly for things that are quite new or that there's not a lot of studies or not a large balance of evidence, that you do look at the ways that the evidence is created and think about it.
And that's why I quite like the idea of trying to hold beliefs probabilistically and provisionally, so that, like you said, there's almost this human hunger for a binary thinking. It's either 100% true or we can never know anything. We might as well just give up or fabricate things. There is actually a middle ground in between, and our beliefs and our evidence doesn't have to be perfect for it to be useful. I'm sometimes joked on these conversations that I can't even be 100% confident that you exist and that you're sentient because I'm just seeing pixels on the screen. But I'm confident enough in the high 99%. I'm confident enough that it's still useful for me to take vaguely sensible decisions in my life. So there's a sensible middle ground there. So
yeah, that's right. There's a way of taking the balance of evidence in such a way that, and weighing up costs and benefits of being right or wrong in one direction or the other as well.
But, and also, as you hinted at, weighing up the costs of doing more analysis. There are some things that are so vanishingly unlikely for me. There's an infinite number of things for which there's no evidence. So I'm not sure how you'd even choose which to investigate. So I think it's also fair to say, look, it might be true, right? But it's so crazily unlikely. It doesn't make sense for me to invest lots more time investigating it because there are an infinitely long list of those things that seem to be somewhat arbitrary.
That's right.
But one of the interesting links between this first question and the one we'll come on to next, which is what matters morally, is again, that need for perfection and solidity, that psychological need, is one of the reasons why sometimes people are nervous about moving away from a religious or a supernatural way of thinking, because they say, look, okay, fine, the evidence to say that this religion is true is pretty shaky. It disagrees with all the other religions. And, while there's some, good ethics flowing through most of these religions, genuine compassion and community, there are some pretty dodgy things as well, sometimes downright awful things. But at least it's a structure. At least we have some rules, right? If we lose those rules and there is no perfect deity judging us and punishing us, surely anything goes, right? We lose any foundations for morality whatsoever. And I don't share that view, and I'm pretty sure you don't either. So what would you say your morality is grounded in, if it's grounded in anything? What matters to you and why?
Yeah, it's interesting because, like you said, this search for meaning, I think, is what grounds a lot of things. And I guess part of, taking on this strongly naturalist worldview is, in a way, giving up meaning. And I know for some people that's very difficult to say, look, there is no objective fact about what matters or what should matter, and that all of a sudden your life has no meaning in a greater sense. And I guess for me, it didn't bother me so much to take this nihilistic view and just go, okay, that's true. I can still create my own meaning. And so I guess, to some degree, I'd say probably like the hedonist nihilist, and that, okay, nothing really matters, but what matters to me is enjoying my life and filling it with the things that matter to me. And, I'm happy to accept that there's nothing beyond that, and that once I'm gone, then all of that kind of disappears. But it's what I've got now, and that's all there is. So that's what the meaning is for that. And I guess for morality, it's the same thing. I sit in this kind of idea, this moral error theory, this idea that essentially, we're just these evolved animals, that there's no reason to think that there is a set of objective moral facts that we've just been fortunate enough to evolve to track or something like that. So I think I sit somewhere between naturalizing and eliminating morality when it comes down to those sorts of views, in that I certainly don't see any way to make sense of the idea that there are objective moral truths in the world that we're trying to find that just exist independently of us. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But I think what is quite clear is that there's something, and we talked about people having this fear that if we don't have these external rules, then anything goes and people will just go nuts. And I don't know what life is like inside the heads of people who think that's what's going to happen. But I guess when I think of my experience, that's just not what it's like. And so from that point of view, it's just, we've got evolved moral psychologies. We've got, I think, very strong and very deep-seated reactions to things that seem to be quite common amongst most people. I think these are fairly well intersubjectively accepted. And obviously the contents of this can vary a lot, but the sort of deepest moral reactions that we have seem to be quite widespread. And these, I wouldn't say exactly, but things like probably empathy and fairness and cooperation, like these kinds of drives, I think just so strongly shape what it is to have a human mind that that's going to mean that not anything goes, because we're all going to feel that when you've got rules that compromise those ideals, or there's not ideals, but I guess values, these sort of emotionally held values, that, anything outside of that's not going to work. So when people say, oh, if we naturalize morality and it's, oh, we could have evolved some other way or anything goes, it's like, but we didn't. These are the things that matter to pretty much everyone. And if we're going to want to build a system of rules that we live together in so that we could create a society that works, those are the sorts of things that we're all going to want them to be around. Yeah. And things like fairness seems to go quite deep. There's been these experiments with monkeys where they see they'll do some behavior or perform some sort of work for a reward, and that reward, say, cucumber, I think it was. They get given their cucumber and they do it, and that's fine. And then they sit and they watch the monkey next to them do it, and he gets a grape for that same behavior, which is a much higher value reward. And the next time the monkey's then asked to do it for a piece of cucumber, when he saw someone else get a grape, he'll refuse. It's like, that cucumber was a perfectly good reward before, but now it's no longer fair. Now he realizes that someone else is getting more, he rejects it. And so it's this idea that, fairness is something that we probably have quite a strong instinct towards. I think empathy is another one. Like I said, cooperation, this idea that we want to work together. And empathy is probably really the big one when it comes down to it. That's the one that I think guides the fact that we want life to go well for others. I mentioned that I'm a hedonist, but this idea that what matters is the subjective kind of pleasures and pains we have in our lives, and that meaning a big broad scope of things. I think people take this very narrowly sometimes, where they're like, oh, pleasure and pain. And you're like, well, that's just every positive and negative mental state that you're capable of having. That's not just literal pain and eating really tasty food kind of pleasures. That can be curiosity and feeling social satisfaction from being with people that you love. It can be
existential angst.
That's it. Existential angst, meaningful work, feeling bored, or all these sorts of things.
And I think you're right in that we can look to, how our morality likely evolved, and actually how proto-morality evolved many millions of years before us. And I'd argue that non-human animals today and many millions of years in the past had a rudimentary form of morality that was driven by many of the things you mentioned, that reciprocity, tribalism, kin selection, caring for the group, just the evolutionary value of cooperation. So that explains why we might have the sort of raw materials of morality as humans that could be a grounding. But at the same time, that doesn't necessarily say that our evolved morality is necessarily correct or the right one or objectively defined. And of course, there are lots of things that, we've evolved to do behaviorally that are awful as well. And you see this in the naturalistic fallacy when people point to wild animals and say, well, they do that too, so surely it's fine for us. So on the one hand, it's useful to understand that history of how it's come to be. That's descriptive. That doesn't necessarily relate to why we should have empathy or why we should cooperate or why we should. And do you see that it is a problem that there isn't a link there? Or do you think that when we as evolved apes just happen to have the cognitive ability to think about and manipulate these concepts, we just happen to have the ability, if we choose, to construct and develop and refine our own morality? And your hint at nihilism might imply that maybe that those things aren't arbitrary constructions. They're grounded and they have history and we have motivations, but there isn't some external definition that we can look to say, our morality is correct or not. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah. I think that's roughly where it stands, is that, there's no further question that we can ask about whether or not this is the right morality. It's the one that we got. And I think there are good reasons for it. And not that I've investigated this a lot, but I suspect that if you were to sit down and try and construct other ways of getting at what the evolutionary ends were that this was trying to meet, there's probably not a ways of being vastly different that also achieve that. If you do want to live in a stable society that people can trust each other and work together, chances are something like these sets of emotions are going to be the sorts of things, these are the kinds of norms that you're going to need. And some people seem to take it, they're like, oh, if we'd evolved to do these kinds of horrific tortures or whatever, then that would then be moral. And I'm just not certain that there is a reasonable pathway that would lead us to this point of view.
I think they're almost talking about a different thing. They're talking about evolved patterns of behavior versus what we as humans are now deciding morality means as a term and as a construct and as something we, you know, want to agree to. So,
well, that's right. I think the patterns of behavior is then another question. You know, so is this idea that we have these values that are things like, you know, your empathy or whatever, and then exactly which behaviors you should fill in to be the ones that best serve those ends. You know, I guess that's what a lot of moral philosophy sort of some of it aims at and what probably should aim at is figuring out, given that we have these values, what are the ways that best promote them? And yeah, for me, I guess the one that always does come back to is this idea of empathy, that the one thing that I guess we care about, and I guess that we can say is in a way objective, even though it's subjective from the point of view that it's in us, but it's a fact about the world, is our well-being. And, you know, taking well-being, I take a very kind of subjective mental states view on well-being, as we were just talking about. But we've, again, evolved to have these sets of positive and negative mental states which drive the way that we behave, and they're very strong proximate motivators to action. And so these are the things that really matter to us, is making sure that we, you know, have the things that feel good and don't have the things that feel bad.
Yeah.
And when you add empathy to that, what you essentially get is wanting to ensure not only your own well-being, but that of others.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, this leads us on the sentientism path that, well, it's going to mean that we want to ensure the well-being of all beings that are capable of having these kinds of experiences, and that is what sentience is.
Yeah. And I think, and different people who use the term sentientism have different approaches. It's deliberately a super pluralistic approach in terms of, you know, ethical systems and how to trade off interests. It literally just says sentience is the right boundary for moral consideration and take a naturalistic approach. But I think I end up in a similar place to you in that I'm not a moral realist in the sense that there's any externally defined, perfectly objective moral state. In a sense, it is something we construct, but we don't construct it arbitrarily. It has an evolutionary history, and my morality is grounded in a completely naturalistic understanding of sentient beings and the likely nature of sentience. And in a super common sense way, I don't like suffering. I'm pretty sure you don't either. And morality is my decision to care about that. That's not proper philosophy, but it seems in a common sense philosophical way, a middle ground and a solid grounding for morality. But
yeah, for me, I don't even feel like it was necessarily a decision to care about it. I don't think
yeah,
not care about it.
But there's a wrinkle there as well. Because, and this is another interesting part of many people's journeys philosophically as I've talked to them, because I think many people would agree with what you and I have explained in terms of empathy and compassion and the fact that we've evolved to have a concern for others. And in a way, most of our human constructions of morality, almost by definition, when you put a supernatural worldview to one side, which says obedience to God is good, for example, or compliance with this list is good, or whatever it might be, if we put a supernatural view to the side, that concern with the experiences of others and with the well-being of others is centrally important. I think many people would agree, but they might disagree about who the others should be, who counts. And that's a really interesting journey for many people, because the vast majority of people on this planet grow up in an environment where intuitively they have compassion and empathy for their family members, maybe companion animal, and maybe more broadly, different subsets of the human species at some point might, at least in concept, sign up to the concepts of universal human rights or human worth. But it would be interesting to know your personal story on that front as well. How did you start out thinking about moral consideration and particularly non-humans, given you spent so much time with them? How did you go through that journey? And again, where have you got to now?
Yeah, so I guess it's hard to trace back. I've always just loved animals. So that it's been my main interest since I was very small. So yeah, this, I'm saying that I was a zookeeper for a long time. At one point, my mum pulled out this little book that I'd written when I was about 5 years old, where it was one of those things you do at school where you fill in your name and your favorite color and your parents' names and what you want to be when you grow up. And it was, yeah, for me at 5 years old, saying when I grow up, I want to be a zookeeper.
Yeah. Very early.
You did it. Yeah. And you always loved animals and had this fascination with them. And I became a vegetarian when I was 12 years old. So that's quite a while back now. But it was a couple of years in the making, just in that I started finding it really difficult to eat meat. And that was partly cognitive and partly emotional. So just thinking about what meat was, but I also just found it very disgusting.
Because of the association in your mind, do you think, or was it?
It was the things that reminded me of what it was already. So if you have a chicken wing and it would still have a feather on it, or cut into a steak and there was an obvious blood vessel, like those sorts of things just completely threw me. And I ended up at this stage where I'd have to be, while I was eating, to distract myself, I'd have to make sure that I couldn't think about what I was eating. And I ended up going to, it was a cooking class in high school. And the first thing we were supposed to cook was lamb stir fry or something. And we had these gross pieces of raw lamb and I did not want to touch that. And so I was told the teacher that I was a vegetarian so they wouldn't make me touch it.
Yeah.
And I went home and I was like, hey, wait, I could just do that. And then I would never have to eat this stuff again. And fortunately, my parents were very supportive when the 12-year-old daughter in the 90s comes home and tells you that if she's not going to be eating meat anymore, then there weren't necessarily a lot of easy vegetarian options available to eat at that time.
So different now.
Yeah, that's right. So they sat me down and essentially said I had to learn how to cook vegetarian things if I was going to be a vegetarian. So I got all
these recipes. It's a test of your commitment.
Yeah, that's right. Recipes for lentil loaf and tofu lasagna and these sorts of things. One of my sisters very soon after I became vegetarian did as well, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One of those things that to her it just hadn't occurred to her that it was a possibility until that. And I think the same for me until I'd said it in this class. I just hadn't really thought through this is something I could do and this could make my life easier.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess this idea of the harm to animals is always something that concerned me. That this empathy feeling, this concern.
And your family seems very supportive around that transition. How about sort of friends and in your social sphere and at school? Was it difficult or challenging or?
Not especially. So I didn't have other friends who were vegetarian, or at least not for years after that. But I guess no one gave me a hard time about it. So. Mm. Yeah, it was annoying, again, because there weren't a lot of options available. So you'd go out somewhere to eat and there'd be very limited food options.
It's more of a practical thing rather than
chips. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So I didn't have friends who gave a hard time about that. I know some people who did. So actually, the same time that I went vegetarian, another friend of mine wanted to have this when I did, and her parents told her no. They said that she couldn't be vegetarian. Which I thought was weird. I was just like, well, they can't make you eat meat. But from her point of view, the fact that her parents told her that she had to was enough. So there certainly, was resistance. And I remember traveling in Queensland and having people not only not have vegetarian options available, but be very confused by the question. Like, what are your vegetarian options on your menu? And
it's almost like an alien concept.
Yeah, it really was. So it'd be quite strange.
Yeah. And that's, one thing... I mean, always in two minds, right? Because one of the problems with the world at the moment clearly is just the sheer industrial scale of farming and fishing, and the graphs just keep going the wrong way in terms of scale of suffering and death is awful and is not improving in objective terms. But at the same time, in quite a few cultures, it does feel like things are shifting in the acceptability and the understanding of even what these words mean. And it almost feels we're super lucky in the UK, for example, it's difficult. More difficult than many other places, but it almost feels like veganism now is where vegetarianism was maybe 15 years ago. It does feel like there's something in the zeitgeist that's shifting. I won't be happy until I see those graphs go in a different direction, but it's moving. And I've spoken to a couple of people who went, vegetarian or vegan in the 1960s and 1970s. And
that would have been even worse.
That's an awesome level of commitment given the social context and the practical challenges then as well. So
that's right. And just having the understanding. And so it does seem like there's certainly this rise of veganism, vegetarianism, particularly within, I think, Western societies. And you get the availability of products that you can eat and go into restaurants and supermarkets and getting a lot of easy and tasty things you can have, definitely increasing. I think a large part of the reason these graphs are going the way they are is just population changes. So even if the percentage share of vegans is growing, the total number of people is also just growing.
And generally, it's a good thing that we're reducing global poverty. Pretty decent rate, subject to the awful stuff that's happened this year, which has put progress back. But generally, global poverty reduces. Some of that is shifting into increased animal product consumption as well.
That's right. So it's just about seeing this kind of shift follow. I think, I guess if you think about what the right counterfactual is to compare it against is that, if we had the same amount of population growth without this rise of veganism that we're seeing, it would be even worse.
Yes.
Not the case that our attitudes aren't helping animals relative to if we didn't have this kind of improved attitudes.
I think that's a really important point. Imagine how much worse those graphs could be if we weren't making those shifts.
And the hope is, that it'll spread even further. I don't remember where I read it, but it was something like that. Once a social movement reaches a certain point, 15% of population or something like that, you start seeing these really strong snowball effects on the way that it spreads. And
agree.
Somewhere like that.
And we'll come back to this when we talk about how do we think the future looks in the final section. But I think there's also a hope that, many of the fast-growing countries that are developing economically very quickly, one, they have the technical nous and the savvy maybe to actually bypass, as hopefully they'll do on fossil fuels, bypass the path that the UK and the US have taken on farming and factory farming and jump straight to clean meats, cultivated meats, and different types of technologies that will cause much less harm. So they might actually be able to sidestep rather than following the awful path we've been down. But also they often have deep worlds of sort of cultural connection with plant-based consumption and, you know, animal consumption as well, that they can tap into, that hopefully will mean they follow a different path. But let's see. We've already hinted at one of the challenges to a sort of sentientist approach, which is to say, look, only humans matter. We're special, we're distinct, either because of some religious worldview that says we should have dominion and we have souls and animals don't, or because of a sort of, I think, a flawed naturalistic approach that says we're at some sort of pinnacle of complexity, or we're the highest state of evolved being, or we have capabilities that non-humans don't have that mean we matter more. And I think you and I disagree with that, because we focus on the fact that any being's capacity to have subjective experiences is what is all that's required for moral consideration. But there's another set of challenges that sentientism doesn't go far enough. So some people will say, look, hold on, we need to be caring about the environment and rocks and rivers and plants and trees and ecosystems as well. And there's a, you know, big overlap, because as a sentientist, I care about those things too, but I care about them because they're so important to sentient beings. Whereas other people will say, oh no, that river or that rock or that mountain or that plant intrinsically has moral value in its own, even if there were no sentient beings at all. So I'm interested in where you are on that spectrum, the sort of ecocentric or biocentric stances that would go even further than the sentience.
Yeah. So in certain moods, I can certainly bring myself to think that all forms of life have some amount of moral value, but perhaps a different kind. Yeah, one recent book I really liked was Simone Ginsberg and Eva Jablonka's The Evolution of the Sensitive Soul. And one of the things they're doing there is they're looking at how consciousness evolved. And one of the things is they bring up this idea of three modes of being, and the idea being roughly that each mode of being, which is a form of life, form of existence, has its own goals and its own sort of the things that it's trying to achieve in the world. And the first is life, and that's living beings, and their goal is essentially whatever it is that keeps them alive, maintains them as healthy, allows them to reproduce. And then the second, you've got the sensitive soul, which is the thing they were talking about, these feeling beings, and they're the ones that are able to feel pleasures and pains, good and bad. And so their goals are essentially to do with pursuing good feelings and avoiding bad feelings. And then the third level is the rational soul, and that's the ability to value more conceptual things. And that's what most humans seem to have, that we value, you know, autonomy, or we value justice, or these sorts of things that we are able to conceive of and then project value onto. And then those things come to matter for that reason. And I could almost see that as grounding these kinds of different sorts of morality that, you know, in our most basic sense, and perhaps the one that I think matters the most, is the one that links to the pleasures and pains and the suffering. That's what it takes for something to matter to an organism in a very special kind of way. But the fact that living beings still strive to maintain their own existence, and that has some degree of mattering, that perhaps we shouldn't be ending the lives of any living beings carelessly. But I think those are probably quite easily counterweighed by other concerns.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a certain, to me, that a tree is going to matter more than a rock does, because it does have some amount of agency or goals in the world.
Yeah.
And so for those reasons, yeah, beyond just the fact that we need trees to maintain sentient life, that there probably is some value to them in themselves.
Yeah.
Like I said,
that's interesting. Yeah.
It just depends how we weigh it up. So I guess nothing seems to come out as just being this trump card. Even sentient experience is the same thing. It's just because something causes a pain doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it if there are countervailing reasons to do it. And it might be the same way with other forms of life. It just turns out that the countervailing reasons don't have to be as strong.
Because that makes sense. And I really like that structure. I read your recent paper building on their work. And in a way, from a sentientist perspective, I'm reasonably open-minded about if people want to go further and consider plants, for example, or other types of things, partly because I think we do need to be open-minded about where the boundary of sentience is. We should just keep following the science. But again, as we said before, be provisional and probabilistic. Who knows? There's always new evidence coming in about the boundaries of sentience and what entities might or might not be. So we should have some humility there, but also just open to other forms of value, if that makes sense. The key thing for me is that people don't exclude any of the obviously sentient beings from their moral consideration. And that's what, you know, one of my personal bugbears is the center of gravity of most of the environmental and, you know, ecological movements seem to fall foul of that. They seem to have a very rich sort of almost Gaia, generous capacity for concern about ecosystems as a whole and species and habitats and rocks and rivers and plants and trees, but seem to have conveniently carved out from their moral consideration vast swathes of very obviously sentient wild animals, but certainly farmed animals and fish as well. And I find
the experiences of individuals are suddenly subsumed to these other larger, more conceptual goals.
But there's challenges even within the animal advocacy and vegan movements on around those inconsistencies as well. And one of the other areas that's contentious and immature, and I think will come to be seen as more important as time goes on, is that of wild animal suffering. So I'd be interested in your perspective there, because I think many people who, for example, are vegan or animal advocates will still say, okay, but that's the wild. The wild is natural. Natural is therefore good. So it's fine, right, for predation and starvation and, you know, parasitical infections. And none of that suffering matters because it's in the wild and we have a sort of reverence for it. I think you can sense where my perspective is coming from.
Yeah.
I don't know what your perspective is on wild animals.
Yeah. So I certainly don't hold that sort of view. And just last week, Walter and I put out a paper about this kind of comparisons between freedom and suffering and wild and captive animals. And the way in which the wild is often taken to be this sort of bastion of its own virtue, that, you know, not thinking about the ways that animals are suffering or experiencing good lives is a real problem. And I certainly think there's this emerging discipline now, welfare biology, which is essentially trying to ask questions about what are the lives of animals in the wild like and how should we intervene. And so I certainly think that this is really quite important. I guess I have one of the things that so far has not been very convincing to me is the case that they've made for the widespread amount of suffering in the wild. It's certainly the case that there's more suffering in the wild than maybe the traditional romantic view would take it to be.
Yeah.
But it feels like sometimes it's swung too far the other way. So these people talk a lot about predation and starving and all these sorts of things. And I'm not actually sure, and I think this is one of the reasons that we need data, they're sure of how much suffering this actually creates. Like, for instance, you know, being eaten by a predator is surely pretty bad, but it's probably 10 minutes at the end of a 10-year life or something. It's, you know, perhaps not such a huge source of actual suffering in the wild. And it's unclear, you know, based on how quick it is and shock responses that can actually stop you from feeling anything when a large injury takes you quite quickly. You know, not clear how much suffering actually involved in that. And people talk about this fear that prey animals have, but a lot of prey animals are very finely attuned to the actions of predators in their environment, such that you'll see zebras grazing quite calmly around sleeping lions, quite alert if they're hunting, they're not necessarily just sitting in fear all the time. And I do think that perhaps we exaggerate how bad the average life is for the average animal most of the time.
I think there's something in that. And I understand why, in a sense, because I do, in a way, prioritize the reduction of suffering generally over enhancing flourishing in humans as well as in non-humans. So that does intuitively draw you, when you start to think about wild animals, to focus on the suffering as a massive, underestimated, unacknowledged problem. But I think you're right. We're just underestimating the total valence of wild animal experience. So yes, we're underestimating the suffering, but we're also underestimating there must be a lot of positive flourishing and value in those lives as well. They have families and they have satisfaction and they have experiences, and we need that fuller picture.
And so I think, very much what we need is a science to get out there and understand it. And this is where a lot of my work comes back to, is we're just like, here are these questions and we need to answer them empirically. And people can sit here and say, oh, I think the wild's bad because animals are predated, and someone else is, but I think it's good because they like having families. Like, what we need is figuring out, A, how many episodes of pleasure and suffering, roughly construed, does most animals' lives contain? And that's probably going to vary a lot depending on the species. There may be some species that are much more prone to suffering than others.
Yeah.
And then we need to figure out, how do we weight these episodes against each other? What kinds of pleasures will outweigh what kinds of pains, and how are they integrated into this total welfare scores? And
assuming you take a utilitarian view, of course, but
that's right. That's just a background assumption.
But I completely agree in that it's another area where the perfect can be the sort of the enemy of the good, or almost the intractable can shut down thinking. So many people will look at wild animal suffering and think those problems are so difficult, and understandably, I'm so skeptical of human intervention generally, right? Because we see how badly we mess things up so often. That, for me, that leads us to skepticism and an open-mindedness about whether we should intervene and how, and a need for more research and need for more evidence. For other people, it almost leads them to say, let's forget that problem completely. And the one thing I'm confident of is I don't know the answers. I don't know how much we should do, what we should do, you know, if more research required. But I am confident we shouldn't just exclude wild animals from moral consideration because the problem is hard. That seems nuts to me.
Yeah, and unless you have the kind of morality that thinks you should only be preventing things that you yourself have caused, then that's not even bringing up the fact that there are huge sources of wild animal sufferings that we have caused.
Yeah.
Just by the way that we've changed the climate, the way we've changed habitats, lots and lots of wild animal suffering is our fault. But even where it's not, you know, if I see someone being attacked by another human being, that's not technically my fault, but doesn't mean that I'm not necessarily going to intervene and try and help. It's still.
Yeah. And I think I share that intuition, right? Because I think there is something about this sort of omission commission thing, right? Me deliberately causing harm feels worse than me allowing it to be done by somebody or something else. But it links back to the earlier part of the conversation. Whereas if you really, the important thing for me is to try and take the perspective of the entity involved. And from their perspective, that, you know, that their suffering is consistent. They're not worried about who's doing it, why, or whether it's someone's fault, or that suffering has moral salience in its own right, or that flourishing has moral salience in its own. And as you say, it's not really a question of whether we should intervene in the wild. We already intervene at catastrophic scale in the wild. So it's not a question of whether we should do it or not. It's a question of, you know.
And we already do. When we think of things like wildlife corridors that go above and below highways, for instance, that's one very simple way that, like, societies have tried to reduce the amount of wild animal suffering that's occurring around roadkill.
Yeah.
And I certainly agree. The tractability problem to me seems huge. And I think some people in the wild animal ethics literature underplay it.
Yeah.
I think that our understanding of wild scale ecosystems is still very new. It's still very basic.
It's pretty immature.
Again, not to disparage the work that ecologists are doing, because these are hugely complex systems and we get a good grasp on some things. But in terms of predicting the outcomes of interventions, I think we're a long way from knowing what the flow-on effects will be. And with the fact that we could just make things worse is a good reason to not step in necessarily, unless there's good reason to think that either the suffering is just so bad or to think that, you know, there is some sort of slightly isolated example. And things ameliorating our own effects is probably a good example of that. Things like creating nice wildlife corridors and stopping habitat fragmentation so we've got more breeding and more moving around animals not being killed by human settlements. These sorts of things probably do work out quite well. But, you know, interventions to, I don't know, genetically engineer predators so that they no longer eat meat or something, which is among some of the ideas, just the wide scale kind of ecological effects of that are just, I think, well beyond our modeling capabilities at the moment. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think there are much more grounded, pragmatic things that are being done around moving from culling to investigating contraception or fencing or some other things that are much less sci-fi and much less risky that I think we can make progress on. And I think, to me, the central most important thing is to grant moral consideration to those wild animals, because that doesn't make the problems easier, but it gives you a motivation to do the research and find out more.
Well, it's about bring them to the table at least.
Bring them to the table at least and, you know, just try and listen to those voices and understand those perspectives. But it also shifts us away from the standard human default, which seems to be kill them all, right? So whether it's overpopulation or whether it's conflicts between areas we want and they want, just the instinctive jump to culling seems to be something that humans seem to love to do. It's bizarre.
And the other thing is that culling just doesn't work particularly well unless you're in a very limited and very closed off area. So you end up, I'm from Australia, dealing with pest animals and feral animals is probably one of our biggest ecological problems.
Yeah.
And you get problems that, you know, if you cull too many foxes, the rabbit populations boom, and then you have them eating other things. You cull too many rabbits and the fox populations boom and they start eating the native wildlife because there's not enough rabbits for them. Yeah, you get all these sorts of effects that, you know, and you just get animals when things are culled. Animals breed more and more offspring survive into the next generation. So it's not a pragmatic solution.
Yeah, the complexity of these ecosystems is breathtaking, and the sort of second, third, fourth, nth, you know, order effect, extremely hard to model.
That's right. And so, there is this kind of sense in which we need to be cautious. And like you say, I think bring these considerations in. And I see this now, and there's this movement for compassionate conservation.
Yeah.
And yeah, I
was lucky enough to interview Mark Beckhoff, was one of my previous guests.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And I think that's the mindset, right? Yes, we need to conserve our collective environment for all sorts of reasons, climate change, pollution, air quality, all those other reasons. We have this communal space. But the reason we're doing that is because of the interests of each of the individual sentients. So let's do that in a way that recognizes compassion and has compassion for those individual sentient beings. again, it doesn't mean there's easy answers, but let's at least use that as our framing when we're thinking about what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, it's interesting the way in which, yeah, animals can be removed from consideration just by putting in the class of invaders or something like that.
Species, vermin, farmed animals.
Yeah.
Even the way we think about wild animals is amazing as well, because the charismatic wild animals seem to get reverence and praise and enormous amounts of money on trying to save them, as long as, particularly if they're endangered, but the vast majority of wild animals aren't that charismatic and just get disregarded. Us humans are very good at constructing definitions of relations and concepts and categories that serve our own interests. So I think that's partly why I think that taking the perspective of the individual sentient is important, because it can cut through a lot of that stuff. As soon as you take the perspective of that individual being, it cuts through a lot of the bullshit we've created to justify doing some of the stuff we do.
Yeah. That's what I mean. And we do it to other humans as well. People get categorized, into these sorts of ways and suddenly go through the most awful treatment because, they're classified as invaders when they're
And in a way, that's one of the things I'm hoping to do with sentientism in this amateurish way, is that I quite like what a universal humanistic approach tries to do, because it says we are all human. That's what matters. It doesn't matter your race, your caste, your gender, your sexuality. Those things are interesting, and it's an amazing diverse range of experiences and categories and identities. But what really matters is that we are all human. And in a similar way, sentientism is trying to do the same thing. It says, yep, absolutely, but it's not just about being human. It's about being sentient. So in that sense, some people look at me banging on Twitter and think it's a single issue thing just about non-human animals, and it's absolutely not. It's also about human animals too, and all of those discriminations we need to fight against and resist. It's saying that all the reason we care about other humans, and we should, is because each of us is sentient too, and we share that sentience. So I think it has direct implications for intra-human ethics as well as cross species or even maybe cross substrate ethics as well.
I was gonna say, if we can come up with this empathy for all sentience, then the idea is that hopefully that would help everyone. You do stop seeing, certain animals or certain people as like an enemy that should be punished or removed from moral consideration.
And I think that's part of the idea as well, is that it's philosophically neutral. So it's not saying you have to be utilitarian or even consequentialist or deontologist or Kurzgesagt Kantian or whatever. There's a long list of different ways of resolving the trolley problems and thinking about how different interests conflict and what's good and what's bad. It's just saying, you at least have to grant moral consideration and have compassion for all sentient beings. And then we can keep fighting over all the other philosophical detail, but it seems foundationally important to work out which entities get included and which don't. Because if you make a mistake at that level, you can have the most brilliant, finely crafted, nuanced, ethical system you like. But if you've excluded any sentient beings, you're excluding vast swathes of suffering for a completely arbitrary reason. So it seems to me that foundation is more important than a lot of the other details that philosophy spends its time digging into, but then I'm biased. So
it's how a lot of my papers sort of end, is that we talk about trying to come up with these ideas of quantifying the harms that we do to animals and figuring out when they're suffering and what their welfare is like and by how much. And then at the end, you say, okay, it's another question as to what we do now.
Yeah.
All we've done is we've said, okay, this is the degree of harm that this action causes to this group, these particular types of animals. And then depending on our moral system, how we count that harm, and whether we count it in a utilitarian way or whether we count it in a more deontological way or whatever it is, that's another question entirely. But at the very least, what we want is we want that to be put on the table as one of the things that is considered.
I think that's it. And I think that still leaves plenty of space. And this is almost inevitable in a way, just given the complexity of the world, that we will continue to cause harm. And sometimes it's justified by an ethical system to cause harm or suffering or death. But at least it says, in isolation, needlessly causing suffering or death to a sentient being is morally negative. But that will lead people to different places. Yeah, it was still may well be justifiable as a universal humanistic ethics sometimes to still cause harm and suffering. But you wouldn't do it without a really strong, clear, overriding justification. And to my mind, that's one of the central issues that most people who call themselves sentientists end up focusing on is animal farming and fishing, because that does seem like a space where, yes, there are some humans who genuinely depend for their survival on doing that and they have no other alternative. But for the vast majority of people, that does feel like it's needless suffering and death, because it's not zero need, but it's basically a transient taste preference or a social norm being set against the visceral physical harm and suffering and family separation and whatever else of another sentient being. So that seems like a really obvious trade-off that you wouldn't make. And the flip side of that is that if you do think that's something that's justified, it seems to imply that you have zero moral consideration in practical terms for the non-human animal at the other end of that. Because if you're willing to grant it such a minimal level of moral consideration that your taste preference or a social norm would lead you to, you know, see its harm and killing as justification, in practical terms, that feels like zero moral consideration to me. It doesn't feel like any meaningful moral consideration.
Yeah, one of the sort of thought experiments, I guess, I like to run against people who do think that their taste preference is so high that this amount of suffering or is justified, is whether or not they would personally be willing to undergo that amount of suffering to enjoy the amount of pleasure they get out of that amount of food. Because if you think that, oh, if I just wrote these down on a sheet, it turns out this amount of suffering is less than the amount of pleasure I get out of that, it's fine. Would you sit down? Would you walk through the alleyway that gives you that much pain where at the end is a steak restaurant? And I doubt that you would when you think of the actual amount of suffering that these animals undergo, these sorts of things. And so it's just outsourcing. It's like, oh, yeah, of course, I'm happy for someone else to suffer that much in order for me to gain a benefit. But that's not really saying that you think it balances.
Yeah. And as you say, again, it's that switch, right? When you genuinely try and think from the perspective of the entity involved, everything falls away and becomes clear. And I guess this is a good segue onto our final section about thinking about the future, because we are in this slightly strange situation where actually I think most people, even the average person, would still agree with most of what you and I have said. They'd said that needlessly causing suffering and death is something they prefer to avoid, that we need a strong justification. Most people would say, at least in their daily decisions, they do largely use evidence and reasoning for working out what to do and how to operate and how to move around the world. But at the same time, there are patterns of social norms, you might even say indoctrination, that may mean for most people on the planet, that sort of naturalistic baseline tends to get warped, so that most people on the planet do explicitly say they believe things which have no evidential basis. And most people on the planet, I do think, have that sort of evolved baseline empathy and compassion, apart from the odd psychopath. But in practical terms, they don't grant moral consideration, or they grant it in a really odd way that excludes farmed animals, most wild animals, quite often some humans, from meaningful moral consideration as well. So we're in that weird situation where it feels to me like naturalism and a sort of sentiocentric compassion seem quite well grounded and almost tautologically true, which is always a bit dangerous. But most people on the planet disagree with me on that front. So in that context, I guess in this last section, I like to ask, one, if you could flick a switch and make 7.8 billion people, or maybe the 15% we need, you know, to have a much more generous compassion for all sentient beings and to take a more naturalistic approach to understanding the world and working out how to engage with it, what could that sort of utopian sci-fi future look like? How would it be different from what we see today? But a second, more practical question is, how can we practically try and make the world a better place? And a lot of your research and your papers have fed in some different aspects of how we might be able to think about that. Yeah. So I've already asked you what's real and what matters, and now I'm asking you to solve all the world's problems and in a few minutes.
How do we create a perfect world?
Yeah.
A big part of this is, like you say, it's changing people's emotional response. Here, we talked about this a little bit earlier, that the moral emotions seem so important. And even though cognitively people agree with the things that we're saying, they don't feel it. And I think in large parts, that's probably social conditioning. It's what you're brought up to think is important, the way that you're brought up to interact and see parts of the world. And then it's very hard. That's the thing that's very hard to change. It's very hard to get people to feel that real visceral wrongness around a certain action, which is the thing that you usually need to motivate someone to act morally most of the time, to overcome. People do have these sort of these taste preferences and these sort of norms around eating particular kinds of foods. And I find it myself, I'm not completely vegan. I'll still eat cheese products sometimes. And it is because, you know, I have for so long and I really like them. But it can be really hard to engage emotionally on that, even though with meat, I find it very easy. And so I certainly sympathize with that idea that even when you know cognitively that you shouldn't, it's very easy to not act according to that when you don't have the emotional connection. And so it seems to me like that's the thing that we really need to tackle. And perhaps just having this slowly growing vegan movement is part of that, because the societal norms shift a little bit and you might just see people, the more they're exposed. Yeah, I think we're very prone to social contagion and we take on the norms of the people around us, even if they're not what we grew up with.
Yeah.
And so the more that spreads, hopefully the more it will continue to spread. And yeah, the more people think about it and really start to internalize the feelings of it. And when that happens, perhaps it will change the way that we deal with animals. And yeah, I guess the obvious answer to what the biggest things are that we could probably do if we did live in that world, I think the factory farming it's, you know, just the most obvious example of something that is unnecessary and harmful that it would be quite easy to shift away from, you know, perhaps not easy in some sort of economic senses or whatever, but, you know, I've got friends who've talked about ideas for this. It's like working with farmers with incentive schemes of how they can transition their farms into certain plant-based crops, having people go and look at their farms and go, look, here's the kind of crop that would be perfect for your land. Here's some money to help with the cost of transitioning to that, or, you know, whatever it is, that there may be ways of making sure that there aren't people who are losing their livelihoods, that you can change things for the better. So there are these sorts of things of going transitioning. And I think as well, the clean meat initiatives are a really good way of perhaps helping people who have the sort of the low motivation to be able to transition to something that is easy once it's available, large scale, potentially cheaper as well. I know it's very expensive at the moment, but because of the sort of the different amounts of space and resources you need to grow a lab steak as compared to a cow steak, I think it's going to turn out in the end to be cheaper and easier to produce, which is just going to put economic incentives to producers and economic incentives to consumers. And so these sorts of things, allowing people to have the things that they want in a less cruel way, is going to make a huge difference.
I think it will. And I agree. I think there's something about practical, making it practically easy, fast, cheap, available, easy. And obviously the plant-based alternatives and things are just much more prevalent and widely available. There's still issues somewhere. And I think that will just continue to accelerate. And as you say, you know, the cultivated meat, the clean meat stuff will just, the quality will keep coming through and the price will keep dropping. And I think it will, you know, ultimately almost get to the point where people are essentially living a vegan lifestyle without ever having decided to go vegan, right? It will just become so easy and automatic. It will just happen. And interestingly, I think what that often does is, it in concert with this sort of increasing social normalization of veganism and animal ethics and so on, will free people to upgrade their ethics, if you like, as well, and almost snap back to the ethics that they deep down they really have, right? People do care about animals. They don't want to cause suffering. So it will almost make it easier once you're no longer part of that system.
Yeah,
to bring that to the fore. I think the thrill of that cognitive dissonance just dissipating will be, I think that will be helped by the social and the practical shifts.
Because, at the moment, if you do have that, it means, I think, one of the ways of dealing with that sort of cognitive dissonance is to shut down your concern for animals a little bit, or just to not think about it. I know a lot of people who essentially just say that. They're like, if I think really hard about it, I'm horrified, but I just don't really let myself think about it very much.
That was me. I was explicitly avoided thinking about it because I knew where it would lead me to go. And that's a bit sad, really, but I think that's a strong default.
But you
mentioned another type of initiative that I really like as well, because one of the dangers when you do care deeply about non-human animals is that you can come to see humans as the enemy to some degree. And I can appreciate that because, yes, our species has done some amazing things, but it's done some awful stuff as well. And so I empathize with that. But at the same time, we need to remind ourselves that humans are sentient beings too, and they deserve our compassion, even the ones who are causing harm. So I love the ideas of that you mentioned. Organizations like the Rancher Advocacy Program and a bunch of others are not seeing animal farmers as the enemy. They're trying to help them transition. And like you say, if, you know, we can, those things are all reasonably small scale at the moment, but if we can massively scale them up. And again, as you said, if we can get governments who are currently channeling trillions of dollars and pounds, you know, into subsidizing ongoing animal agriculture, despite the climate challenges, despite the zoonosis, despite the antimicrobial resistance, despite the animal ethics.
That's bizarre, is that it's not actually an economical viable industry as it
it's
is.
Breathtakingly it's wasteful. Right? Nearly all of the inputs get turned into piss, shit, and sweat, right? It's, even if you take the ethics out of it, it's just crazy. Right? If someone came to you today and suggested animal farming as an answer, scratch, you'd think they were totally nuts. But so if we can get those, you know, subsidies shifted into, you know, what some people call a just transition, which I quite like because it's just transition, just do it. But it's also do it in a just way, because there are farmers and communities and people whose lifestyles are dependent and tied up in these industries. You've got to find ways of helping them transition to a less harmful way of living.
A large part of resistance that you get and this kind of polarization comes from not respecting what it is that motivates and guides people on the other side, as it goes, the people who are farmers who do work with animals in certain ways, the reasons that they have for doing that, you know, particularly in small scale farming, a lot of farmers do care about their animals, you know, and a lot of, I guess you get people who are the more hardcore animal liberationists who just deny that could be true, but you see it. It's just their version, like in their head, what it means to care about an animal is a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
But they certainly don't want to cause harm for no reason.
And that's partly why most farmers you know, don't do the slaughtering part of the process themselves. It's also, they do care about their animals. It's just a sort of psychological thing of you pack them in the van and off they go and try not to think about it too much. It doesn't mean those people don't have compassion.
Who, yeah, have just economic challenges. So
yeah.
I had some friends who run, that's now wheat farm, but they attempted to do pig farming for a while, but they wanted to do it in a high welfare way and just found that it was impossible to do and sell the product at the price that it cost them to produce. And you know, the sad reality is that, yeah, you can't price well high welfare meat with the cost, what it costs to produce, then people are going to do it the bad ways. And if there are people who care enough and who are being given incentives not to, and you know, the factory and the factory farms and the intensive farming pushes away from that, you can't really pay attention and care a lot about animals when you've got tens of thousands of them or whatever it is. But
yeah, I agree. And I think that's maybe that's a hopeful note to finish up on, is that I hope we keep continue on that journey, because I don't think that there really is any ethical way of farming animals at all. So I have quite a purist approach, and I think that will be the end point of the journey, because even if we have a situation where you have a super high welfare, long happy family life, and then there's some form of painless death at the end, I still see that as something I prefer not to do. I still don't think that's ethically supportable, let alone the reality of what animal farming actually is, which is very different from that. But regardless, you don't, even I would have much in common with many people, even many people who consume animal products, who absolutely hate the idea of factory farm. So even though this is feels like a bit of a cultural war thing and there's different sides, there's enormous common ground around certainly the worst excesses of animal farming and fishing. And those are actually the highest scale as well. Nearly all of it is ultimately, sadly, intensively right. farmed.
Yeah, so I certainly get people who talk about the idea. They're like, oh, but humane farming would be okay. And almost none of those people make an effort to source only humanely farmed meat. So it feels like a little bit of a dodgy rhetorical device. But yeah, if we lived in a world where all intensive farming was shut down and there are only more humane farms left, which, like you say, there are problems, you know, wrote a paper about humane slaughter and questioning the idea, because loss of life is a harm. You do lose future opportunities. But you know, even if you had that, that would still be much better than what we have now. The idea that all or nothing are the only two options on the table instead of some improvement, that would still be something I'd be happy with, and maybe not as an endpoint.
I agree.
As an endpoint.
Yeah. And I think there's common ground there. And I liked your paper, because one of the other thought experiments I quite like doing, some sentientists do insist on a sort of trying to achieve a sort of full egalitarian approach where all sentient beings, you know, have exactly the same moral consideration. Although I think even they, you know, would break down under the thought experiment of you can only save a chicken or a human child from a burning building. What would you do? Right? I think most of them would still prioritize the human. I take a different approach, and I think other sentientists do this as well, where they recognize that sentience is rich and various. To my mind, it's a class of information processing, so it has enormous variety. So I am open to thinking about grading moral consideration in different ways, as long as that baseline is strong, that you still, even the minimally sentient being, you wouldn't needlessly harm or kill. But I think I'm open to that idea of grading. But at the same time, it's quite an interesting thought experiment to take someone's ethical thinking about a non-human animal and say, would that work for humans? I'm not saying they're exactly the same, but just conceptually, if there are entities that you have some form of meaningful moral consideration for, when you apply that way of thinking to humans, if it sickens you and horrifies you, there might be a conceptual, you know, mistake somewhere in your thinking. And I have had, you know, as a vegan on Twitter, you have all sorts of amazing conversations. And I have had a couple of people bite the bullet and say, no, human toddler farming would be ethical, because as long as they live a net positive life and are euthanized peacefully in their sleep, it's absolutely fine. It's pretty rare people will bite that bullet. So
yeah, that's
an interesting thought experiment. But I think you're right. I think there's, even with people who viscerally disagree over some of the fundamentals here, there's also a lot of common ground and a lot of prospects for us to make positive change quite quickly. And that won't just benefit non-human animals. It will benefit us humans as well, for some of the reasons we've already set out. Are there any other sort of themes about the future that you'd like to see develop positively?
So I think one of the interesting things that looking to the future that we can think about is the role of enhancement technologies. The idea is that there may be ways of enhancing ourselves and other types of animals that reduce the amount of suffering we may experience or enhance the amount of pleasures that we can experience. And these may actually be good ways, particularly if you're utilitarian, of increasing the amount of sort of value in the world that, if we're able, and there are a lot of things that we do that are shortcuts to this. You know, you go out in the sun and having sunshine on your skin boosts your serotonin levels.
Yeah.
But, you know, what if we could artificially do that and just, you know, gene edit so that everyone's got higher serotonin levels or whatever it is? I think, you know, It's very science fiction-y in that, you know, our understanding of human genetics and human development and brain processes is still very young. And I think figuring out how to intervene in such a way that you create the kinds of benefits that you dream of is something that we're still quite a ways from doing. But yeah. I think there's still interesting things to think about there that you could actually, you know, make lives better by just making people happier, making animals happier.
No, I agree. And again, I think it echoes what you were saying before. There's an understandable focus on reducing suffering because of the ethical impact of that. But sometimes we forget about the positive enhancement side of things. And while some of that is crazy sounding sci-fi stuff, I talked to David Pearce from the transhumanist movement, and there's some really interesting science going on. Some of that might sound quite sci-fi. It's happening quicker than we think, right? With gene editing and life extension technologies and just the usual stuff about fighting human diseases and longevity enhancement and so on. A lot of that stuff is actually fairly ordinary and is happening already. But also that's one thing a lot of people focus on, is finding ways of enhancing our own experiences. And whether that's meditation or psychedelics or just different ways of having a happy, fulfilled life. Those things are important too. It's not just about the suffering side of the equation. So.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. And people can be resistant to this, I think, because they worry that there's something unnatural about it. But there are certainly, we think it's perfectly fine to go for a run to boost your endorphins, or like I said, go out in the sun to boost serotonin or whatever. So I can't see why artificially doing those same things is suddenly just really morally sketchy.
Yeah. And I think, again, it's I like the term naturalism because I think it's a broader concept than just science, right? It's about using evidence and reason generally to understand reality by engaging with it, honestly. My only frustration with it is it sounds a little bit like the naturalistic fallacy, which we've talked about here a couple of times, which is one, because something is natural, like the wild, it must be good. But it also can stop us from really positive opportunities because we have this sense that it's unnatural and therefore we shouldn't do it.
That changing things for the better is
yeah, and it's good. We should be very skeptical of humans and our psychology and our hubris. We know the dangers of that, but that shouldn't blind us to the opportunities for making things better either. And again, I just come back to have that universal compassion, follow the science, be prudent, and don't let that naturalistic fallacy
work together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is why it's been brilliant to talk to you, because having that sort of interdisciplinary combination of experiences led you to have a fascinating career path so far. So before we wrap up, what's the best way people are following you, learning more about your work, reading your papers, keeping up to date with what you're doing?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Zoo Philosophy. So I share most of my work there. And I've also got a website as well that updates for all my recent publications.
I'll include the links in the show notes as well, so people can click through. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, Heather, for taking the time. And like I say, it's great to have you on our wall and in our Facebook group.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?